Hello, so welcome to Seaviews. I'm Junior Gosling, and today we have Darren Gard with us from New Zealand, all the way the other side of the world. Welcome, Darren.
Thank you. Yep, glad to be here.
So it's Darren's dinner time, but for me and Adam here in the UK is breakfast time. So hello, Adam. Good morning to you.
Yeah, hi, hello, Julia, and hello, Darren. And yeah, thanks very much for dialing in at this relatively unsociable hour. So thank you.
That's fine. No, glad to be here.
Yeah. So we're going to pitch in with a talk about fishing safety, well, global fishing safety. And, you know, we haven't looked at this topic for quite a while on Seaviews. So we thought it'd be lovely to get a bit of an idea of what's happening in other parts of the world. And Darren, I'm really pleased you joined us because I know from your work, you have guard safety and you've worked in this. It's a passion of yours, fishing safety, isn't it? And it's also your business, it's your life. So I'd love to just hear a bit more about how you got into that and what started you off on this road.
Yeah, it's been a reasonably long journey. Where do we start? I'll start from the beginning. So the Gard family, we're New Zealand's oldest European descendant fishing family. So this is actually next year is our 200th year involved in the New Zealand commercial fishing sector. So as you can imagine, my great-great-great-grandfathers were fishermen, and my grandfather was fishermen, and my uncles were fishermen, and my fathers were fishermen. My grandfather, Jack Gard, was a very well-known New Zealand wooden boat builder. So he built over 100 traditional timber hull fishing vessels throughout his career. His first one was at the age of 11, believe it or not. And his last one was pretty much at the age of 90. So there's a lot of guard boats around. So look, I grew up on boats fishing. It was school holidays. It was, you know, dad needed a crew, all of those things. So out I went, out on the local inshore, just small sort of, you know, 12 to 18 meter traditional timber fishing vessels, a mix of trawling for the likes of New Zealand flounder and red cod and snapper and a bit of dredging. Mm-hmm. And I progressed throughout the business. You know, when the weather was bad, I was helping building boats. And when the weather was good, I was actually out there fishing. And, you know, I progressed through the business. I started off on running their smallest boat when I was 18, which was a little 33-foot Destiny G. Then I worked my way up to, in 96, actually, my grandfather built me a vessel, the Kathleen G. So Kathleen G was my grandmother, by the way, so Kathleen Gwynn. And just to tell you how embedded fishing is to the family, at the launching of her in 96, I also proposed to my current wife.
Wow, you had quite a year, didn't you? A birthday gift of a vessel, and you got engaged.
Yep, quite a year. So, yeah, proposed and then went fishing and pretty much got home about 3 hours before the wedding itself, about 12 months later. So pretty much that's been me. And, of course, throughout my journey, I've seen a lot of injuries. I've seen a lot of fatalities. One year in 1991, we lost 11 fishermen on bar harbours. Wow. You know, New Zealand's reasonably notorious for some of their bar harbours, particularly mm-hmm. Westport and Greymouth. So that sort of started me thinking, this is, you know, crikey, there is a bit of risk associated with this. And then I had a near-death experience, I guess, which, you know, you mentioned earlier. It was just me being young, silly. Wrong place, wrong time, overloading, too much fish, too small a boat, too bad a weather. Rang my wife at 1 o'clock in the morning to say goodbye. She still hasn't forgotten me. You know, that was 20 odd years ago and she still hasn't really forgiven me. So, and you know, we've done quite a few stories on that. And then largely, it was a family business. The family retired in about 2010 and I had the choice, do I stay fishing or do I get out? Because it's all I'd known was inshore commercial fishing. But I decided, you know, they got out and I decided I would as well because the opportunity came up to do something a little bit different. And it was actually Maritime New Zealand here that offered me a role as industry trainer and industry liaison. So mm-hmm. going from being a commercial fisherman straight off the water to working for the regulator in that sort of environment was a challenge. But I'm the sort of person that likes a variety and likes a change and pretty adaptable and flexible. So I did 5 years there, which I really enjoyed. But then, yeah, largely I was approached by one of New Zealand's largest fishing companies. They were having a challenge with their let's just say, the health and safety on board their vessels. And they approached me and said, you know, what would you do? And I remember I wrote them an email and said, this is what I'd do. Next minute, I was on a plane being flown to headquarters in Auckland and asked, when can I start? I thought, hang on, I didn't even realise I was having a job interview. So I did 3 years there, actually, at Sea Lord, and it was a fixed term for 3 years. And when I left, I was pleasantly surprised with some pretty high praise from the board of the organisation, just, you know, saying it's the lowest injury rate that they'd ever had. I think we had their lost time injury frequency rate, which is, you know, the measure per million hours worked, down to 0.5, which for a fleet of nine fishing vessels with over 1,000 people at sea, we thought that was, you know, pretty good. And then from there, I actually set up Guard Safety. So I sort of thought, well, what I need to do, I'm very much about culture, working with the people, putting things in plain language that fishermen can understand. You've got to understand the language, the drivers, the challenges, and be able to speak their language. So I set up Guard Safety about 11 years ago. We provide health, safety, and well-being. We've done quite a bit in the fishing well-being space to the wider seafood sector now, or the maritime sector. So it's not just fishing. We do passenger vessels, work vessels, you know, coastal vessels, all of those. So, yeah, we've been doing a bit of that, and it's, I mean, hey, I just don't like seeing injured people, and particularly with our friends and family.
This is a theme that I see with many people that have done, you know, really worked in safety and really get it. Everybody's seen people that they know or love go, and it, you know, is something you don't want to see anymore. And it does seem to be a real drive. It's obviously a driver, isn't it? So everybody's lost people in their communities. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've looked at sort of different things happening in fishing and safety all around the world. I don't know a huge amount about New Zealand fishing industry. Can you give me a little picture of what it's like? What is the picture of the industry in New Zealand?
I guess it's changed, I guess, would be probably to summarise. But, I mean, we had a quota management system came in 1986. So pre-1986, we had about 3,000 commercial fishing vessels. And largely, they caught what they wanted to catch. You just needed a licence and a boat. Quota management system came in 1986. So everyone was allocated a quota based on their catch history. So if you had a high catch history, you got a high quota, et cetera, et cetera. And then over time, I guess what's happened is a lot of that quota has migrated to predominantly about five or six larger corporate organisations. So our fleet has shrunk. I mean, we've probably got about 900 fishing vessels, commercial fishing vessels in New Zealand now. They're a mix. The average size of a New Zealand commercial fishing vessel is actually not large. It's 11.24 metres. So we still have a lot of small inshore vessels that they number probably around that, you know, over 800 of the 900, and we've got something like about 30 deep-sea factory vessels that sit around that 60, 65-metre mark that do the deep water. They're processing vessels, a crew of 45 to 50. They do 6 weeks at sea. They bring in a product ready to go to market. So, you know, they're a floating city largely. So you've got a range of inshore and deep-sea. But, yeah, it has, I guess, rationalised quite a bit. And I think part of that is because it's got hard. It hasn't actually got hard because of the lack of fish. We have sustainable fisheries, but probably unsustainable fishers for a multitude of reasons. And I know when I was at the last iFish conference in Rome, and I know that was talked about up there about the well-being and the pressures, particularly on the artisanal and inshore fishers. And we're seeing that as well, to be perfectly honest, where there's the price of fuel's made it quite challenging as well. So we are seeing a rationalisation, but I'll be here until the last fisherman is here and comes home safe, as simple as that. So for me, it's just as good as it was when I was 14, 15 going to sea. If there's one fisherman here still fishing, I'll be here to support them and make sure they come home, you know, with all their fingers and toes and home to their loved ones, because that's the most important thing.
There's a couple of things you just said there, which are, I think we should really stop and celebrate. You said an LTIR of 0.5. I mean, that is excellent in any industry, let alone the fishing industry, which is, you know, statistically, unfortunately, has a much higher rate than that. So That's amazing. And you mentioned about focusing on the culture, which is that, I'd love to hear more about that, because culture is the hardest thing to change. You know, everybody recognizes that. Behaviors and actions are pretty, relatively simple, but to get that culture, so that's great. And I suppose with your wealth of your experience, literally from both sides of the fence, you know, from practitioner, builder, manager, regulator, or at least as a consultant, you've got almost a unique perspective. So I'd love to hear more about, you know, what is it you did that managed to make that change in culture?
I built a bridge between the regulator and the regulated.
Mm-hmm.
I was a communication channel. I listened to the policymakers and what they wanted to achieve. I listened to the fishermen. And of course, I knew what was achievable, what was unachievable, and largely brought them together. I've done a series of things as well. I'm also, about 11 years ago, I set up the New Zealand Fishing Industry Health and Safety Forum. So I chair that currently, and largely we've got all of our large fishing organisations together talking and collaborating on health and safety. So that's a sideline. So I'm now currently working on changing the wider culture in the industry, which is going pretty well. But going back, I guess, to the business, to getting it down to, it was 0.54, it was understanding them, understanding the drivers. There's three things that drive fishermen. The first one is family. The second one is money. And the third one is competition. So if you can pull on those three levers together, then they will follow you. And if you've earned your stripes, like the first thing I've noticed, if you ever get in a room with fishermen, they suss you out. And all seafarers are the same, right? Whether they're merchant or fishing. Yep. They want to know that you've been wet, and they know that I've been wet, and they know that I've had the frights and I've made the mistakes, and I'm not perfect. And let's all learn from our mistakes and share those and celebrate our wins, I guess. But I think one of the most effective things that I did was I went to sea with them all.
Yeah.
And I did a couple trips, part trips on each vessel. And I did a report, did a bit of a risk assessment. You know, went the simple hazard spotting exercise, created a report for the board. And then before I sent the board the report, I would go to the skipper, and I'm giving away some of my tricks, I guess. And I'd say to those guys, I respect you as a skipper. This is your report.
Mm-hmm.
You get to remove one item. But if I remove that one item, then we are in business together. We're collaborating together. We're working together. And that one item that you remove, I will be checking that like a hot rash, and we'll never be doing those things again. So I got their trust. And then all of a sudden, you know, vessels that didn't really, I guess, enjoy health and safety or focus on it or value it, there was a lot of value, and made it simple, understandable, achievable, and practical and relevant. All of those things, like, made it fit for purpose. The language was fit for purpose. Their safety management system, so we have, at that time, it was the New Zealand Safety Manager, Safety Management System. These days is a maritime operator safety system. Plain English, where there was a 5-page form to fill out to report an accident, it became 2.
Yeah.
Used lots of pictures, videos, encouragement, very much used the, you know, we're in this together model, but hearts and minds. I'm very much about, let's have a conversation about, you know, an injury, a life-changing injury for you or any of your crew, what will it do for your career, your partner, your children? Mm. And I've got a lot of one-liners, like being unsafe is being selfish. You know, there's no secrets in safety. If you're doing something better than the other boat, I'm stealing it and I'm going to give it to them, and you should be happy about that. So, you know, I've done a couple projects, large projects on culture in the fishing industry, and they've both, you know, I mean, I don't talk very often, but they've both been recognised as pretty significant. One was years ago when I was at Maritime New Zealand, and I was heavily involved in a program called Fish Safe, where we delivered pragmatic health and safety training to inshore fishers, over 1,000 inshore fishers. So our accident compensation corporation that pays out for injured workers, at the end of the program, they said that they recognised that for every dollar spent on that program, they returned 5 and reduced injuries and claims.
Wow.
So I've had a couple of those things. And is it a philosophy? Do I have a thesis and a PhD? No. But I know the industry, I know the people, and I seem to know the levers.
Yeah.
But it's not that traditional, to be honest.
That's a key thing, though, isn't it? Like, regulators and fishers are never going to meet exactly in the middle. But if there aren't people like you, and I know people in other parts of the world who come from fishing, who are fishing, and they have to be, like you said, in between there somewhere, like working a practical solution, because otherwise... Yep. You know, coming straight from a regulator, if they don't really understand fishing as well as fishers, these rules, you could make as many rules or great safety laws as you want, but they can't or they won't be accepted. And I see that being a great model that you use, you know, being respected within your industry and people know that you've done this stuff, you've been there and done it.
I'm going to use your own words against you here, Darren, a bit, which is if you see something that's good, it needs to be stolen. I talk to lots of people who, in different ways, say what you just said, try to be the bridge between the regulators and the regulated. And I don't think there's any lack of willingness to try and build those bridges from both sides, but you seem to have found the secret sauce. So whatever it is, you need to bottle it and give it away.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I can imagine.
and it's influence. It's influence. You know, I'm an influencer when it comes to health and safety. And
a finfluencer.
Oh, nice. Yeah, there you go. That's that. You're onto it. And the other saying is, look, you're always going to attract more bees with honey than vinegar. So I was never the big stick sort of a person. If you've got to use the big stick, you haven't explained it well enough, you haven't sold it, therefore have a look at yourself, look in a mirror, because you might not be pitching it correctly. So, you know, we're currently working on an approved code of practice as well for critical risks in the fishing industry. I'm heavily involved in that. So we're working with Maritime New Zealand, the industry, and other stakeholders. So that's quite an interesting project at the moment as well. And you know, again, in that, one of the learnings is we have to acknowledge the difference in standards between inshore and artisanal vessels and corporate deepwater vessels. Yeah. They're actually largely two different industries, same industry, but they're completely different. And you can't measure them with the same ruler. It's just not reasonably practicable or fit for purpose, because each has their own way of achieving the same level of safety. One probably uses more innovation because they don't have the budget, and the other just throws money at it. But they are equally as effective, I believe.
Yeah. I want to touch on something you talked about, the inshore fishers in New Zealand probably struggling these days. And it's the same in the UK. And I imagine in a lot of places, you know, costs keep going up, probably the costs of admin as well and bureaucracy and regulations, that all goes up. And I know that inshore fleet here are very pressured. It's not just about not making money. I think we all see that has a real effect on your mental health and well-being. Is that an area that you deal with as well, Darren, with guard safety or with your other work?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been working in particularly the fisher mental health space since 2019. We were originally engaged by our Ministry of Primary Industries and been working in that space sort of ever since, worked with the industry and others to put a program together, basically, you know, First Mate New Zealand, which is seafood sector support. We've created a lot of resources for mental health. If you go on to like marinesafe.nz, there's fisher-specific mental health resources, training videos, all sorts of things. Largely, I've been selling ice blocks to Eskimos over most of my career, like whether it's health and safety, introduction of the Health and Safety at Work Act, new survey standards, and now, I guess, mental health. Actually getting fishers to openly talk about it and seek help, which we have achieved, it's now a day-to-day conversation amongst our industry. That's been the hardest project I've done. Such a male-dominated thing, but every fisherman is a teddy bear when you get them away from the other fishermen, and every one of them is hurting. We've done a lot of research, worked with Fatima Junard at Massey University. There's obviously Dr. Tania King in Australia. There are some tragic statistics out there for commercial fishermen and their mental health. When you start to look at it, you can't look away. I think it's, you know, mental health is obviously something that's been increasing globally across, I guess, most populations. But when you look at the fishing specific, I know Australia themselves are saying that mental health amongst fishermen was double that the national average of farming. Now, we found here very, very similar, like huge rates. And it's, you touched on regulation and compliance. So we've actually done a research piece here. Let's just say the findings were unpopular with some that found that regulation and compliance and the additional burden and cost that places was the number one stressor for our fishermen. But then you've got other things like, you know, there's obviously societal expectations, environmental expectations, all the new standards and regulations. There's time away from home, the remoteness, you know, just the actual environment. You know, health, it's pretty hard. You know, healthy living's hard on a boat, particularly a small boat. So there's all of those factors that come together. So largely to work on the mental health, you know, it's a multifaceted approach. Like we've got multiple sort of, I guess, points that we work on to help fishers. And yeah, it's quite mainstream now, which I'm pretty proud of, but it's hard work, it's tough work. And largely it starts at the top. So it has to start with the regulation, the regulators and the stakeholders and what they have to do. I touched on earlier that I believe that, you know, we might have sustainable fish, but not necessarily sustainable fishers. Mm-hmm. Globally, there's been billions and billions of dollars spent on sustainable fish stocks. What's actually been spent on sustainable fishermen as people, as human beings and their families? Not very much. So if we, it's great to have healthy oceans, but if we don't have healthy people to harvest that, to feed the masses, and we'll always have fishing, it's food security 101. But I think we need to put more emphasis on the fishermen and their families. And again, it's a different approach. When we started this project 6 years ago and we Googled mental health for fishermen, nothing. There was just a very quiet space. I actually presented on it in Rome at the iFish conference. When was that, 2 or 3 years ago as well? So some of the pieces of work we're doing. And yeah, I'm proud of that and still doing that, but there's still a lot of work to do. But it's hard work, but incredibly rewarding. Again, I support fishermen with the whole ecosystem of existence and just what we do largely.
Yeah.
That is an amazing achievement. I mean, well, you touched on it earlier, that sort of male dominated type of environment where you've got, like you say, you've got to present yourself as a relatively sort of roughy, toughy, you know, nothing's going to faze me type guy. Getting people to talk is probably been the hardest nut to crack, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, without a doubt.
You know, looking at your what you've done in New Zealand and your industry there, you talk about sustainability and the people bit being really important, like one of those important pillars. You can't just look after the fish, you've got to look after the people that are actually fishing. And I know you haven't just worked in New Zealand. I understand you've got a funded project with the International Fund for Fishing Safety and that you're working on some international fishing safety work. I'd love to know a bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're very fortunate to have some of the fund from, you know, IFS, and it's a pity Alan's not here to bathe in some of the glory because he was obviously heavily involved. What we're doing, because I've also got a, you know, 73% of global fishers, and we all know the injury rates, you know, whether there's two figures, isn't there, for fatalities of fishermen. There's one at about 36,000 annually, and then there's one up to 100,000. But either way, one is too many.
Yep.
But 73% of them have never received any form of safety training. And how do we expect those stats to improve if they can't, if they've never experienced any knowledge or training? And, you know, with my experience, I guess being an inshore fisher myself for many years, it's just near impossible. How do you get a fisherman that has to work every hour that God gave them to pay the bills and stay well and catch fish and all sorts of weather? How and why would we ever expect them to come ashore, sit in a classroom, which might as well be Mars to them, and sit and listen to learning? So that's actually why we created MarineSafe, which is marinesafe.nz, which is an online e-learning platform with health and safety training resources on it. And it's free. And it's freely available. So that means some of the fishermen, you know, have, you know, levels of literacy in that vary. They went to sea to avoid the paperwork and administration. Unfortunately, that's catching them on the water. But you give them a smartphone, everyone's got a smartphone and they're a magician. They can do all sorts of great things. So they can do our training online. And then I thought, well, that's gone pretty well in New Zealand. And, you know, sort of looking at the statistics up around, you know, the Pacific and Cook Islands with a lot of those artisanal fishers, and, you know, there's tens of thousands of them, they have very minimal opportunity to access any training at all. But the only common factor is many of them still have access to a device of some sort. You know, fishermen prioritize their toys because they want to reward themselves because they feel they've fished so hard, they've provided so well, they've made so money, I'm going to get a little bit of tech. And it doesn't matter whether it's a dugout canoe on a beach in Vanuatu or whether it's in a Honolulu. That's just how fishermen are. So, and with the invent of the likes of Starlink, so our project is to develop the Marine Safe Pacific project. So we're going to adapt Marine Safe NZ, and we're going to create a Marine Safe Pacific model with different various of health and safety training resources relevant to their culture and their fisheries method, largely to enhance the coastal fisher health and safety and well-being in the Pacific communities. And for those that don't have connectivity, because connectivity is a thing up there, we've got the wonderful thing, the game changer called Starlink. So, you know, for $400 or $500, I can buy a Starlink kit here, and I can, as long as I've got power of some, you know, whether it's a generator or whether it's 12 volt, I can train 20 or 30 fishermen sitting on a beach anywhere in the world using some of the most modern, you know, interesting, engaging safety training. All they've got to do is connectivity and a device. And even if they don't individually have a device, someone in that community or that village has got a device. So we're setting up knowledge hubs or center of excellence where there's someone looks after the device and, you know, they're the keeper. It might be the chief of the village. It might be the, you know, an elder, a partner of somebody, and that they're going to become training hubs in all of these remote communities. So we're in the pilot phase feasibility study, but it's looking incredibly positive. And as you can tell, I'm reasonably excited about it because I know the difference it could and will make globally eventually. It's just a no-brainer.
It's brilliant. And I think people don't realize how remote still so many communities are in the world. I mean, I've been with the International Fund for Fishing Safety. I've been working with one of the projects, well, several of the projects, but one of them out in Uganda. And they're going out to very remote communities on Lake Victoria. And, you know, these are days, the only way to get to them is by boat. These are days away and they are, you know, artisanal style fishing. So they're not going to be going to a 2-day journey to go on a course. That's not, it's just not happening, as you can see from the fact that they haven't had any training. So it's actually really hard to get out to these places. So looking at a practical solution like that using the technology that we have now as well, I think it's great. It's a really exciting project.
Yeah, no, we're pretty excited about it. And I think it'll be, as I said, we're working with SPC, they're our partners up in that area, they're a very important stakeholder. And I went to the heads of fisheries, so all the heads of fisheries from the 27 nations all came together in Umeå and we did a presentation on it. And it's fair to say there was a high level of enthusiasm. And so we're currently running a pilot with one country, one nation, and another one sitting there just to test it. But look, we're very confident. We know it will work. It's where it goes from there, because I think it could be a game changer for, you know, a lot of fishing safety globally. And one of the other things, the benefit of it is, you know, New Zealand's reasonably advanced with maritime safety and health and safety. And, you know, I'd like to think that we're reasonably well up there. This is an opportunity to send some of these developing nations, give them a 10 or 20 year jump, because they're going to be using the same training that we do, obviously designed into their culture and their fisheries, but it gives them modern technology and modern training methodology that they possibly wouldn't see organically for 10 or 20 years. Yeah. And if you think about the benefits of consistent standards, we talk about harmonizing standards across the globe. Well, hello, this is the methodology to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. That was going to be a point I was going to bring up if you hadn't. It's a great concept.
Yes, so, I mean, things might need adapting, but they still are working towards an international standard that that we know should apply and that can work around the world. And actually, that's a great point to just mention something that's coming up. So the Cape Town Agreement is going to come into force in February in 2027. I think it was Argentina was the country that tipped it over when they ratified. So that's great. And it's going to, therefore, it'll be coming into force in New Zealand in February, won't it, Darren, which is a regulation that I know it's the larger vessels, but it is one of these important international fishing safety standards.
Yeah. And again, it's all about harmonisation, really. So for New Zealand, what does that look like? Well, it only impacts the over 24 metre vessels, which is our minority of vessels. Yeah. So new builds over 24 metres, we don't have a lot of those, but there will be some. And vessels over 24 metres that operate in international waters or the unlimited waters. So it's a small portion of our ships, but it's really good to have another standard to look at and to gauge our, I guess, you know, benchmark ourselves against global standards. We have quite a robust Maritime Transport Act that largely describes all of our, you know, shipping, all of our construction standards, life-saving standards, you know, training, and obviously, you know, STCW and STWF. So we've got all those things as well. But I think it's definitely going to be a really useful tool, but it will add to our current suite of tools, which is the Maritime Transport Act, the maritime rules that are under it that are more prescriptive as to what you need to do to improve safety on your vessel. And we also have the Health and Safety at Work Act, which came in 15, and that requires vessel owners to take all reasonably practicable steps to keep themselves and the vessel and cargo and everyone else safe. So there's a lot of synergies between all of this legislation. And what we will do is the likes of when the agreement comes in, it will just be another example of best practice that we can refer to sort of harmonise and meet international standards. And of course, globally, it gives everyone an opportunity. They know that any vessel they're going to buy from any other jurisdiction is at a certain standard and they're all consistent. So there will definitely be some benefits for New Zealand and the globe, I believe.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of positive news.
Positive news, but I think it only applies to about 2.5% of the global fleet. So it's a massive step forward. It's taken an awful lot of effort by a lot of people. We shouldn't underestimate the amount of time, and it's been years. But hopefully it's a sort of foundational stepping stone rather than the head knock.
Yeah, I think we've got some really positive things coming up. And Darren, your work is really interesting. It's really worthwhile. I definitely think I should include the Marine SafeNet link in my show notes because it's a great free resource that you've developed, and I will include that. Is there any, if I could ask you one thing though, Darren, if you could improve anything, just one thing in fishing safety, your wish list, what would it be?
Oh, that's a very good question. And what would it be?
Only one.
I think that those that make the rules listen and collaborate better with those that are impacted by it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think making things relevant, understandable and achievable, I think is really important.
That's a good one. And I put you on the spot there, Darren. Very good. That would make a big difference. Doesn't always happen, sadly.
No.
Well, thank you so much for... Adam, do you have, before we wrap up, do you have many reports from the New Zealand area for CHIRP?
We do get some, not as many as I'd like. And, you know, when you talk about, and actually I'm really pleased you brought that up, Julia, because going back to Darren's earlier point about being a bridge, that's effectively what we do. As CHIRP, you know, we're a confidential reporting service for people that want to raise an issue but don't want to have themselves associated with that issue. So they want to keep their name or identity out of it. And that's what we've been doing for sort of 20 plus years. So actually, I can see a natural synergy there between people, you know, when people want to raise an issue that they're either worried about the blowback or the ridicule, or they're worried about sort of somebody not listening to them, taking them seriously. That's what we do. And we do it very discreetly, do it under the radar. And hopefully, you know, if there's a space at all down in anybody, you, with dealings with people, and they, you know, they're like, well, I've got an issue. I don't know how to sort of get it out there and air it without being involved personally, you know, do bear owners in mind, because that's exactly what we do.
Yeah.
You might get a few new reports from New Zealand, because CHIRP, you can report anywhere. There's lots of ways to report. And for 20 years, you haven't had, you know, you have not had any problems with anonymity. 20-year record.
It's all been very, yeah, exactly. But, you know, actually, it's not about us. It's about the people that make the reports and making sure, as Darren said, making sure they get help. And, you know, to use a cliche, a rising tide floats all boats. So I'm really excited to hear about your initiative. I wish you the very best in growing that around the Pacific. I'd love to hear more about it, and I'll keep a weather eye out for it, because it sounds like a fascinating initiative and overdue in many ways.
Yeah, yeah, really fascinating. Yeah. I'm watching that one with a lot of interest.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Darren, you also have the Gleam Fishing Channel, which I know is really popular on YouTube, and that gives out a lot of information to fishermen. Why did you start that?
Really, it was something we started about 14 months ago. And actually, that's, you know, my colleague here, Oliver, sort of, let's just say, keep suggesting that maybe we should capture some of my stories and some of our family's history. And I had a quiet moment, and we went around, and very poorly planned, I guess, and went around and sat on a fish bin or a fish crate behind a fishing company. And I talked about the Gard family history in association with the fishing industry. Thought nothing of it, put it on YouTube, set up the Gleam Fishing Channel on YouTube, and it had 16,000 views.
Wow.
And unfortunately, a lot of positive comments and a lot of messages. So from that point, we couldn't stop. So we've been, yeah, it's a labor of love, let's say, but it's really important. I put safety messages across. I want to showcase the awesome careers within what we talk about, the blue economy. But there's a real lot of characters in our fishing industry and a lot of history that I don't want to see it lost. And once it's online, it's forever and a day.
Yeah.
I love it. And I think you're a great storyteller, and we don't learn safety or something important like that from a list of instructions. Yeah. We learn it from stories that help us understand it. And I think you're great at that, Darren. So I'll definitely put a link to that. Yeah. So we'll ring the bell and we'll leave the bridge nice and safely today. And thank you very much for joining us on Sea Views.
Fishing vessel Great Pole, Coast Guard, VLP.